Thanks for joining us at the Canadian Breakpoint, a Canadian infectious diseases podcast by Canadian infectious diseases physicians. I'm Summer Stewart, back with Dr. Rupina Pirawal, pediatric infectious diseases physician in Saskatoon. Today we welcome Dr. Thomas Duchesne, founding director for the McGill Center for RNA Sciences, to discuss mRNA. Dr. Pirawal.
Thank you, everyone, for joining us on another episode of our podcast, The Canadian Breakpoint. So today we have a very special guest with us, and we're going to be talking about a lot about mRNA technologies, which we actually haven't done an episode on. So I am actually super excited to learn a lot from Dr. Duchesne. So Dr. Duchesne is a professor and chair of the Department of Biochemistry at McGill University. For more than 28 years, his research elucidated the genetic and molecular basis for the functions of mRNAs and non-coding RNAs in the control of gene expression across a diversity of physiological contexts and in cancer. A renowned expert on mRNA biochemistry and molecular genetics, his research program currently details how 3' untranslated regions of mRNAs and their interacting cofactors dictate mRNA translation, stability, and decay. He mentored more than 40 trainees over the years, most of which later led careers as independent researchers or scientists in academia, as clinicians, and in RNA-related careers in industry. In most recent years, Dr. Duchesne led initiatives to translate deep expertise on RNA at McGill and in Quebec towards industry and clinical applications, among others, by founding the McGill Center for RNA Sciences, which he currently directs. So thank you so much, Dr. Duchesne, for joining us today. We are super excited. We're going to talk a lot about mRNA.
I'm always ready for that. Always up for that. That's
of course. So just as a background, our listeners are healthcare professionals. We have nurses, physicians, trainees. So a lot of people, and I think just general audience, that are interested in science and technology. So for background, can we maybe give our audience a bit of history on like when mRNA was really introduced into medical therapeutics?
I can give you a bit of a breakdown for this. For the common people and most of us out there, whether it's in the clinics or I know our daily lives all over the planet, RNA messenger RNA-based therapeutics really became visible with the COVID-19 vaccines introduced, approved by FDA in 2020. But for that form of prophylactic, like for many other therapies or treatments, you really have to look way back to really trace, you know, how this emerged. As a matter of fact, messenger RNA-based therapeutics have been in the works for nearly 60 years. Since the very discovery in, I think it's 1961, actually, the messenger RNA is, you know, people quickly realized the potential for their treatment, for the user's treatment. So really what we saw emerge in recent years is really the tip of the iceberg for about 60 years of hard work by dedicated researchers. In Canada, just in Canada, for example, in our own backyard, there's the work, for example, of Naum Sonnenberg and Jerry Peltier at McGill made us understand how messenger RNAs could be translated and used as tools. People like K.K. Ogilvy made the first chemically synthesized RNA, but also at UBC, for example, and this is a huge contribution directly applicable to the vaccines, was the work of Peter Collis and his team at UBC. On lipids, really, fatty acids that are so important to make those little bubbles of fatty acids that can bring RNA into cells. When he presents his data, it's like 40 years of hard work where he had a hard time getting funded for that research, but that really is so important. But that was also in the U.S., as was celebrated with the Nobel in October, the work of Catalin Carrico. Mm-hmm. And Drew Wiseman, which really was a cornerstone of use of RNA as a vaccine, right? So, Catalina actually, when she talks about, and in her Nobel lectures, she speaks of how hard it was to be funded on that research when nobody believed that RNA could be used as a vaccine. And, And Drew actually, and Dr. Wiseman supporting her for believing in her vision for so long, that led in 2005 really at the major breakthrough that allowed messenger RNAs from exogenous sources to be translated into cells. Well, I'll talk a little bit more about this, but it's really a visionary contribution that allowed messenger RNAs to be used in vaccines. Beyond that, also there's other major contributions that happened in most recent years. And in the background, people don't know about this, but there was Moderna working really hard on using RNA as a vaccine against cancer. Pre-COVID, mm-hmm. this was going on. They were working on treatments of cancer based on messenger RNAs, vaccines against cancers, right? Who would imagine for several years? And there are also other forms of RNA therapeutics that allowed this treatment that was going on. The first RNA-based therapeutic, RNA LNP formulation, was approved by FDA in 2018. It's another messenger RNA, but it is siRNA. And it was the works of the RNA Therapeutic Institute at UMass Medical School with a drug called Entrapo. And this really was, I would say, one of the stepping stones that the vaccine that we saw emerge. So you know, for most of us, we say, hey, where did that come from, and how came to save so many people in the world? And right. did people just become a genius where they ignored this potential before? But it actually is the fruit of so much basic and discovery work, and people who really fought the hard fight for many years. I'm saying people, but it's also companies like Moderna and BioNTech that carried that ball for so many years in the shadow, but now we see it emerge.
You know, being in the medical community during COVID, like you said, even myself coming up with mRNA vaccines, I think that was kind of our first exposure. And I mean, we learn about mRNA, of course, like in medicine, and but never really like translated how this could be kind of the future of some of the technologies that we, you know, mRNA based therapies. And so definitely, like myself, wasn't very familiar with it. So obviously we've known about it for a long time, that these are the technologies. Is there any other reasons why we wouldn't have been able to bring about therapies, or why are other companies, you know, like what was the difficulty with mRNA as opposed to kind of our other conventional therapies and models?
Yeah, it's a very important question, because I think it put the spotlight on how big of a contribution these folks I just mentioned and many others have made.
Right.
I think it was on back burner for so long because RNA really, because of its chemical properties and how it interacts with cells, really, you know, there were a lot of barriers to overcome in order to use it as a drug. So there was so much time between the discovery of messenger RNA and lipid nanoparticles. And its ancestors, right, that used to be called liposomes and whatnot. There was so much delay that kind of fell on the back burner. And some of these barriers really were overcome only in the recent years. So I'm talking, for example, about the in the chemical properties of RNA. One of the key things is that how it's different with DNA is it has a 2' hydroxyl group. So it's chemically really something that is a handle, and over it reacts really easily. It forms an intermediate that degrades the RNA. So my jargon essentially means that the RNA is unstable. It's not meant to last forever, right? It's really a plan that you bring on the construction site. You're not supposed to keep it forever, right? It's something that's meant to be destroyed fast, right? Where another issue is that it's polar. So you look at the chemical groups on that thing, and there's no way it's going to enter the cell easily, right? So membranes are not polar. So RNA really wasn't meant to be used as a drug at all. And usually when the cell receives these signals from the environment, it's usually because you're in trouble. You either have broken cells or you have viruses around, and you certainly don't want to have the virus RNA getting into your cell. So there's a whole barrier also that the cell used to say, hey, this is not ours, right? And it's self versus non-self. So it's called innate immunity, and there are several cascades. There are genetic programs that make sure that RNA floating around doesn't get translated in your cells. So this is the discovery really that Carrico, Kathleen Carrico did in Wiseman, they figured out a way to change, chemical modification on the RNA to hide it from the innate immunity. So, and that's only 2005, right? That's a recent breakthrough. But the other challenge and distribution were really overcome with the lipid nanoparticles, which is, packaging these messenger RNAs inside those lipid bubbles and mm-hmm. making sure that it gets inside cells through routes that the cell use. You have many vesicles and lipoproteins that are uptaken naturally inside the cell, and those LNPs use some of the machineries that those routes naturally use. So we started mm-hmm. harnessing essentially those pathways to get stealth RNA inside the cell, hide it from the immune system, and this allowed the messenger RNA to do its job inside the cell. So this overcoming those barriers took a long time, and right. I think that's why when these people were fighting the good fight, it kind of fell in the back burner in spite of the potential, to a point where people like Carrico couldn't get funded and, mm-hmm. and you really had the visionaries getting at it. So I, as to why we haven't heard about it until recently, I think it also was because the need, the planet just say that, if you look at the so-called imbalance in death, it's about 20 million people that this vaccine saved. Not even mentioning, getting back to work after the pandemic when we barely understood the coronavirus and everybody was scared at home. This really, really came about quickly because there was a need. In a way, Rupi and I think about this, and I think the most amazing thing about it is how fast and how well the humanity falls together and works together to overcome major challenges, right? It happened key points in humanity. And we really can overcome major threats like this when we work together. And it's not only people, like I said, it's companies, it's university work, it's academia and industry and people and companies. It's just amazing how we can find solutions to huge demands like this. To me, it's another lesson of how people can collaborate to come up with solutions that impact the whole planet.
And honestly, I mean, it's years and years of research, right? So it's not all of a sudden that these things come up, like from what you're saying even now, is that you have to work, if anybody's done research, they know that there's hurdles. There's a lot of ups and downs that you can have, but you really have to, and you really have to kind of keep working at it, because there is certain technologies and certain methods that over time you can excel at and fine tune.
So, that's the key point. That's the key point, Rupina, and it's time, right? You need to keep your eyes on the long game, and that's what research is about, biomedical research and discovery research. It takes a long time, and it's not that and the application research. You need both, right? So otherwise you end up, really quickly out of steams for innovation, and not even mentioning the fact that you are outcompeted by other countries that do it properly. So, what you're saying is exactly right. It's a matter of when you need things in the short term, you can mobilize, you can translate knowledge, but mm-hmm. you need that depth of knowledge, quality of knowledge, and that comes with research. So you really should have both.
Yeah. And so you mentioned some limitations, obviously, of the mRNA-based methods, being unstable. There's, you need money, funding for to work it up and to also kind of build these technologies. So what are some of the strengths that some of the mRNA-based, methods provide compared to conventional methods that we use in other therapies?
Yeah, so there are really two key points about RNA, messenger RNA therapeutics that people should have in mind. And I think they reflect really, really well how they're disruptive and transformative for the whole drugs or therapeutics or prophylactics ecosystem. The most important point is that this is a new kind of drug, a new kind of treatment. It's an information drug. RNA mm-hmm. in itself encodes things. It's information, right? So if you change the sequence of that RNA, you have a new drug. So chemically, it's the same thing. It's the same chemistry. It's the same RNA molecule. You're just changing that plan. What's written in there changes. Yeah. And that changes, in the case of a vaccine, will have a new antigen. So you'll have a new target for a new virus, for example, just by shuffling the sequence to something new. that you want the immune system to target. But you can also encode other forms of messenger RNAs that have other purpose, so-called modalities, right? So you could, for example, program cells, the T cells, which is one of the modality called T cells. So you can essentially harness other forms of the immune system and direct it, let's say, to treat heart disease. And we saw, for example, application like this last year in Nature, where they repurposed a lot of messenger RNA really close to the formulation that was used in the COVID vaccine. Messenger RNA and LNP was reformulated to program CAR Ts, and they used it to treat scarring tissues in the heart disease and improve heart capacity after heart failure in the mouse system. So by changing the RNA sequence, not only do you have a new target for your immune system, you can even change a type of drug. It's extremely versatile, extremely powerful, because before, when you develop a drug, you were limited to receptors and enzymes. And every time you develop a new small molecule, it took forever. You had to go through clinical trials and whatnot. So what I'm saying is that you have more targets also. You have far more therapeutic targets, not only for immune immunization, but also as potential drugs. And also you accelerate the process, because every time you have a successful vaccine or a successful RNA messenger RNA modality that works in the clinic, you de-risk the next innovation wave. So this ultimately, I think, is going to accelerate or at least change the game in clinical trials. I don't think it's going to happen right now, because these are new drugs and people are worried and they want to make sure they're safe. But I expect this to change the process of clinical trials, I think, in the mid run. Of course, when you have new technologies, you want to, you know, play everything safe, making sure that people, it's acceptable, and you cannot make mistakes when you have this transformative kind of drugs, right? So that, and I know companies like Moderna, for example, aware of this, and they're extremely careful in their clinical trials now. But I think at the mid to long run, we'll have to reinvent how those clinical trials are run financially, and also in terms of also choice of disease. You have disease that are we call orphan disease, because they're so the courts are so rare. There's so few people that have access to those clinical trials, because their clinical trials are expensive, but you also need large cohorts. And you can easily imagine how, you know, such a versatility and how fast, how easily you can repurpose them and de-risk trials, that you'll have cohorts and people that, you know, were equity seeking, just couldn't enter in clinical trials. And they just weren't the right subtype to favor the economics for development of those drugs, now having access to those therapies. So I give you three advantages. One of them is it's an information drug. You just change the sequence, you change the target, you change the modality. The repurposing that de-risks the clinical trials. And finally, I told you that some people or treat or disease could not have access to the traditional form of clinical trials now maybe gaining access to treatments that are RNA-based. Those are just three of them, but you can see how important this is going to be in the landscape for economics, for example, of pharmaceutics and whatnot. Yeah. This huge game changer.
Yeah, very scalable, which is, I think, a huge advantage of an mRNA-based method, as opposed to, you know, like you mentioned, having to change the entire framework of the therapeutic modality.
Correct. So, yeah. So you, instead of reinventing the wheel and going through the whole de-risking from A to Z, you build on previous success to de-risk the next step, because what we call it, drug repurposing, right? At the greatest, I would say, level.
And also, as like being in the medical community, I mean, first having scalability, that's really important, because we're always looking for novel agents, especially as new diseases are coming up. Like you mentioned, there's rare diseases, and sometimes we're, you know, because we have a lot of diagnostic testing, I think, that overall can find rare diseases now. But when we come to therapy, so even if you can diagnose them, if you don't have a therapy for them, it becomes challenging, right? When you're a clinician.
That's right.
And so,
so it's all the concept of precision medicine, right?
Yeah.
It was all the concept of precision medicine. You can stratify your disease, say, hey, you have this subtype of disease, this subtype of, what do you do if you have nothing to treat it, right? Yeah. So you start a clinical trial for that rare subtypes. It's going to take forever. Nobody's going to get in clinical trials. So it's pretty sad, right? You already die. You have the wrong subtype. Let's say in cancer, the wrong subtype of cancer. And you're sorry out of luck. But with this, now you can have much smaller scale trials, just because the you can, on one hand, design a drug or a vaccine against that type of cancer by just changing the sequence. And second, you have a lot of prior clinical trials to de-risk even smaller cohorts.
And that's the key point, right? Because a lot of the fear and the scare comes from not knowing what the molecule is like and how we can utilize it. And so I think that's where, if you have that information from other trials, that's majority of like what we do with research and, you know, as base, or even when clinicians are using therapies, we look back at those research trials for assistance, because we want to see how often did this therapy work, right? Because it's obviously, it's usually you're using it kind of outside of the norm, or not really off label per se, because it's probably, you know, once Health Canada goes through the approvals, et cetera, then, and then you have an indication for it, but you still have to resort back to clinical trials. So I think the research aspect is huge.
The key thing, though, that you referred to, I think, affects also the general public, not only the clinicians. It's how fast this happens, right? And how fast the emergent, you know, we're just catching up to those new realities. So clinicians have science and they can refer to clinical trials, right? And even though it exploded in recent years, you know, in 2020, I think there were a handful of those in the first year. And now we're about 3,000 clinical trials that are mRNA based, about, you know, I think it's about 700 of them are against cancer. Vaccine clinical trials, that's something that is completely new. You wouldn't think would be possible. Since 2020, now we have 700 clinical trials going on. And I look at the data for these and they're very, very promising. Things like pancreatic cancer, for example, melanoma, and subtypes that usually won't work now are actually within the range of those therapies. Concepts like neoantigens are being used, for example, to make new types of vaccines against those diseases. It's currently exploding, and both clinicians and I would say the general public have a hard time catching up. And this will rightfully, I would say, raise some concerns, or at least need to get access to the right information. I think, Rupina, that's why your podcast is so important, because you're bridging that science with the not only clinicians, but general public. So thanks for doing what you do today. But we still have a lot of catch up, both clinicians through the clinical trial data, but also with the general public. Because, you know, when they're, you know, sitting at home, they're being told, now show your arm, right? And for the injection, you have something to get injected in there. But, you know, now show me your children's arm. Show me your kid's arm so that we can inject those new technologies. You know, we really do, as scientists and caregivers, and also I would say policymakers, have to listen. We have to hear. We have to listen from what's happening on the field. And we have to understand those concerns so we can address them. And we also need to educate ourselves to the science underneath, and also the limitations of this science, not promising anything magical here. Anytime you put something foreign in an arm for injection, whether it's a vaccine or not, there are risks. There are risks. So the right question to ask is it perfectly safe? Because it's not. The right question to ask is it less risky than having a viral infection from a coronavirus that can kill? Another good question is it safer than what we currently have, for example, at the vaccines? The answer to those questions is by far yes, right? It was tested at the planet-wide, during the pandemic. And these formulations of RNA in vaccines now we know are much safer than the prior modalities that we were using, and far safer than being infected by this this coronavirus, right? That the planet hadn't seen before. So I guess my point is about social acceptability, Rupina. Not only for clinicians to use the full toolkit and understand and be able to answer questions to patients, but also in general, right? If you're not careful about this and you don't listen, people will be worried and they will actually respond, right, by not accepting the treatment. And you may have patients that end up suffering because they rejected that treatment. Or you'll get people on your Parliament Hill with trucks, with horns, because the policies, you know, were not explained, or the general public is not ready to accept something moving so fast. So it's a lot of words, but I think, you know, I'm touching upon the speed, how these are implemented. And I think there's an important challenge there, following up on the strengths of these and potential of these therapies some of the weaknesses clearly have to do with social acceptability.
Yeah, and I think we all face this, you know, whether it was from a professional or a personal standpoint. You know, you always thought when the pandemic hit, I think it was everything, there was a lot of anxiety. There was a lot of, everything was very fast paced, right? So new disease, learning environment, whether it was thinking about yourself getting the vaccine or giving it to others, like a lot of us clinicians became vaccine administrators at that time too, because that was just the, you know, and really weighing out the risks versus benefit, like you mentioned, right? Yep. And so that was the key point. Yeah.
As a scientist, you're there, you go, you look at the papers and you read the papers and you say, oh, okay, that's what they know. That's what they're shooting in my arm. Oh, I see the chemistry here. As a clinician, say, okay, well, then, you know, they've had some prior trials. They can, you see on triples, you see, oh, this LNP is not really new. Yeah. It's a messenger RNA, so we have it. But the general public who doesn't have that science, right? Mm-hmm. They're blindfolded. They're blindsided, and we're being asked to trust the government, right? When in a really angst-generating period with the pandemic. So, you know, if you put yourself in their shoes, there's a lot of education to be had, right, with those technologies. I can tell you, though, in my mind, there's absolutely no doubt that these technologies will just accelerate, right? They're talking about replacing the influenza vaccine that we get yearly, for example. Yeah. This is going RNA. I mean, right now, you know, it's not very efficient. It's peptide-based or I think it's adenovirus-based. So they're going to shift to RNA. So it's just the start. So for the, you know, on one hand, we'll have messenger RNA vaccines for things that we were exposed to before. But when there's a new pandemic, because there will be other pandemics upcoming, there's coronavirus and bats, you know, in Southeast Asia, there's going to be more in that incubator. And, you know, population is more mobile. We travel a lot and we're more dense than ever. People are concentrated in cities more than ever. So, and there's poverty, and there's also, you know, all spectrum of I would say the cultural and practice that will affect distribution of those viruses. It's going to happen again. And guess to what they're going to turn next? They're not going to go backward with the technologies that, you know, were supplanted by the messenger RNA vaccines during COVID. It's going to turn to messenger RNAs because it's faster, it's cheaper, and it's versatile, and you can reprogram and repurpose the modalities that were reliable before. So it's here to stay, and it's going to replace and supplant many of the technologies. It's really, when you think about it, disruptive technology in the, you know, the meaningful sense of the word. And the better we know about those as clinicians and scientists, the better we are to answer questions by mom, daughter, cousin, but also our patients as well, right? And make, you know, make them understand to the extent that we know, because we don't know everything about those still, right? What are the risks and what are the advantages? Yeah.
And which is science, right? So that is the evolution, right? And that is... And that's not only based on mRNA, that's anything. So we, over time, and that's kind of why there's many steps of, there's, when you're doing a project, whether it's a small scale project or a large scale project, there's many milestones that you reach during the process. And then once it's out in the market, you also do a lot of post-market surveillance. And so I think that's kind of where the focus has been for my practice in my area with counseling, is really, really letting people know that, understanding that this is years and years of knowledge that's coming together. And not only that, we're still watching it. So there's an evolution. So I can't guarantee that what I know today is what I'm going to know in 10 years, because that's not how science works. Science is always about knowledge and learning, right? And so we're reflecting on this ongoing. And so what we know today about mRNA is probably much, much different than we knew about 40, 50 years ago. So, which is
absolutely
fantastic.
And there's a good system of checks and balance in science, but also in clinical applications and in therapy development. We really keep those with checks and balance. It's not to say it's a perfect system, but if, you know, there's flaws, they will be seen sooner than later. But this being said, you know, I think that we need to keep an eye on those new technologies, that's for sure, and you know, change whatever we need as soon as we capture any evidence of flaws.
And I guess just to touch on that safety kind of aspect, I always get questions around, because this molecule is very unstable and, you know, we can change it in so many ways, does it actually affect my own genetic makeup? when I'm taking these vaccines or these treatments. And so kind of what's your thoughts on that?
Yeah, it's a question that I hear a lot. And I think it's very important for people to have a satisfying answer to that one. RNA is not like DNA. I know it's only one letter as an acronym, but fundamentally, chemically speaking and biologically, there's millions and millions, hundreds of millions of years of evolution made sure that RNA really had different purpose, a different biological purpose than DNA. DNA is something that you want to keep as a hard drive memory of who you are as a species and transmit it to the next generation. Whereas RNA is really a blueprint, something transient and degradable. So RNA is messenger RNAs anyway, are really meant to be read, used as a blueprint on site and then destroyed. It's actually on purpose that it's destroyable with that special chemistry, right? So when you inject a messenger RNA in the cell, it's not going to last very, very long. So keep in mind that there's about 400,000 messenger RNA in every single one of your cells right now. Every single one of your cells have 400,000 of messenger RNAs doing their job. They're not going back in your genome. they're read and destroyed, and they constantly produce from DNA. DNA's job is the memory. The messenger RNA's job is to be transient, read, and destroyed. And its very chemistry is make sure that it doesn't. There are really, really rare cases where RNA, and maybe that's part of the confusion, RNA can be reverse transcribed and inserted in genomes. And that's the job of rare viruses we call retroviruses. But that's because RNA can be also modified to, you know, play weird tricks. But that's not the messenger RNA's job. That's not what the chemistry and the biology of messenger RNAs do. And the ones that we use, the formulation or types of messenger RNAs that we use with its chemistry is really the product of about 60 years of intense study by millions of people worldwide. There's groups working on the RNA, in labs for, since the event, its discovery in 1961. So we know about messenger RNAs. They're not going back into your genome. It's really something that it doesn't do. So, and I think it's important for people to know that.
And so we talked a little bit about obviously we're using mRNA-based methods in prevention in vaccines. But you also mentioned a bit in treatment of diseases, for example, cancer would be a common theme. Are there specific diseases or, like you mentioned, for prevention, I think vaccines is kind of the key player there in influenza for the future. Are there other current modalities that are, or current therapies that are using mRNA-based technologies that you'd like to mention to our audience today?
Yeah, I'm super excited about the cancer vaccines and what's cool about it, it's not only as prophylactic. We talk about vaccine as if they're prophylactic to prevent, but actually some of the clinical trials right now use cancer vaccines as a treatment. So for, there's one actually that was published in Nature in May, 2023. And that's actually really promising. There's a couple of others that are in parallel where what they did is they took the tumors, the patient's tumor, and they identified bits that are unique to the tumor and absent from the patient. So called neoantigens. So cancer shuffled the cards and in a way that you can find bits of information there in the tumors that are not present in the rest of the patient. So you take this information, and because RNA is so flexible and you can really generate vaccines so fast, you generate a bank, a library of messenger RNAs that would immunize against those very same neoantigen. So you actually identify the Achilles heel of the tumor. You immunize while the patient is ongoing clinical trials. You immunize against its very own neoantigen, and you can treat it this way. So it's not really the traditional prophylactic use of those, right? Yeah. So, but eventually, you know, what my understanding is that eventually they will find some neoantigens that are common. Let's say in pancreatic cancer, they will find neoantigens that are multiple of those cancers, and they may use it as a prophylactic as well. You were referring to other use of messenger RNA therapeutics. There's, for example, the cell programmable form of cells, cells that we call CAR T. So they're essentially, you probably heard about this. They're cell-based messenger RNA therapeutics. And the idea there is to program the immune system to redirect it to serve different purposes. There's huge potential for messenger RNA therapeutics there as well. It's another so-called modality. And it can go and treat things like heart disease, for example, just to name one of them. So the different modalities are based on messenger RNA are quite diverse. And there's also flavors of messenger RNAs that are in development, things like self-amplifying messenger RNAs. So you add a bit of information, the RNA, so that it stays longer. You keep them, you amplify the messenger RNAs, or circular RNAs that, you know, are messenger RNA linear. You have a five prime and three prime end, and it's part of its behavior, but you can also make it a circle and the RNA lasts longer this way. And there are many, many uses for the different forms of RNAs. They're apparent to messenger RNAs, but there are different modalities, I would say, that are emerging that can modify the pharmacokinetics and pharmacodynamics, but also the types of targets that you can challenge with those therapeutics. All of this has different level of development, but I think the first assay, the self-amplifying RNA, was just approved by FDA a few weeks ago, as a matter of fact. So all of these are different stages of development, but they will emerge in therapeutics soon.
Okay. So the vast majority of indications, definitely, when we're looking at kind of what we're targeting and also what these modalities will be eventually be used for. So a lot of ongoing research. Yeah. That's awesome.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of other modalities. Also, there's the siRNA based. They're not messenger RNAs, but they're RNA based, like CRISPR, for example, where you engineer the genome and can change your cells forever. But there's also lots of cool research done in chemical biology, new modifications of RNA, adding bits of sequence to the RNA so that we decide where and when the RNA is expressed. You know, I work on three prime untranslated regions. Those bits of information decide where the messenger RNA works, really. And there's a lot of cool stuff done on lipid nanoparticles and other nanoparticles. Again, the delivery of the RNA is a huge challenge. And, you know, not only pharmacokinetics, pharmacodynamics, to which tissues it goes, how long it distributes. You can even change, tweak the response of the immune system by changing the lipids in those particles, for example. But there are other challenges, like, you know, many of people who dealt with those, the vaccines. You need those special fridges to keep them minus 80 degrees Celsius, right? It was a nightmare for distribution. So there's solutions coming to make them more thermostable, right? You have vaccines that you can keep at room temperature and that affects the whole distribution and also ultimately how fast you can respond if something emerges and the availability of the drugs in your practice. So there's research in stability also of those vaccines going on as well. It's going in overdrive. It's very exciting to see this coming. To me, the most exciting part is disease that were out of reach before, like cancer now. Having options with those. So it's a lot of hope for patients that had few options before.
And then I guess just for like my own knowledge, because I deal with a lot of, infections, immune deficiencies, transplant, is there any talk with mRNA kind of in the immune deficiency world or bone marrow transplant, stem cell transplant? Is there any discussions around bringing mRNA technologies for treatment options there?
The intersect between messenger RNA-based therapeutics or RNA therapeutics at large, but messenger RNA therapeutics in particular, and the immune system is a sweet spot. That's where we're successful, and there's going to be more and more uses there. I'm not an expert to precisely answer your question. I'm not an expert, and I don't know really what's being done there. What I can tell you, though, is that of all the clinical trials, most of them with messenger RNAs, most of them have to do with the immune system. And you could have things like chronic inflammation, the chronic disease, right, that are undergoing autoimmunity. I wouldn't be surprised if there's breakthroughs there for with those therapies. I don't know how fast they will come, but if I had a chunk of money to put on somewhere where it's going to move fast, it's going to be on the intersect with the immune system, whereas immunomodulation, but also, we see things like, for example, combinatorial treatment with immunotherapy, for example, in cancer, right? The cancer suppresses the immune system, and you can modulate that with immunotherapies. So there's a synergy between messenger RNA vaccines against cancer and immunotherapy. So you'll see those combinations of treatment in the clinic, for example. So that's a hot space, I would say, to do research on. Rupina, if you want to do some research, I think that would be grantable, I would say, in the current period.
Yeah, no, that's fair. Thank you so much, Dr. Chain. I think, I've learned a lot about mRNA technology and, through everything that we've spoken about today, doing a bit of my own research as well. And I think this is, it's nice to see that there's novel techniques that are coming up, and we, you know, really have a future where we're not only diagnosing diseases, but we have treatment options and really just a better understanding, right? So we have experts like yourself that can come on and talk to us about this. And so I think this is very different from a few multiple like decades ago, where a lot of this information wasn't brought out to the public, wasn't brought out to clinicians and other audiences. And so thank you so much for your wealth of knowledge today.
My pleasure. It's what's exciting is that this is hope that's given from knowledge. It's from solid knowledge, from very robust knowledge. So it's a pleasure to be conveying this to clinicians and the general public. Thank you for doing what you do.
No, of course. Thank you for doing what you do. I think you make my job my day job easier. So it's perfect. And so I think we're definitely, I'll reach back out to you at some point because I think there's a lot of future to mRNA-based methods and technology. I know there's going to be a lot of research in this area, and I know that you and your center will definitely be on top of it. And so I think it'll be nice to discuss kind of future, what the future really holds. Is there anything from a last standpoint that we didn't talk about in mRNA that you were hoping to share with our audience today?
I just think that what we're seeing is the beginning, and that the potential is huge. Everybody is awake to that potential. Yeah. And it's really a very important period to fund research in that area, basic and translational. And the potential now is absolutely clear, and all the players are awake to it. So, I think I would like to close with an appeal to support research, both basic discovery, but also a translational, so that we can start mobilizing this knowledge towards patients that really need it and have few options. So that would be my last word.
Yeah, no, that's great. That's fantastic. Anybody who's a researcher would I think having support in their research would be important, whether it's clinical, whether it's bioengineering. There's so many phases. Yeah,
chemical engineering, bioengineering, basic and applied, I think both need to work hand in hand on those, definitely. We've seen it work really well with this.
No, it's fantastic. Well, thank you so much for your time, and we look forward to future episodes.
Thank you, Rupina.
Thank you, Dr. Duchesne, for the discussion on this interesting topic. Have an episode suggestion? Email thecanadianbreakpoint@gmail.com and be sure to follow us on X @CABreakpoint for updates. See you again soon at The Canadian Breakpoint.